So just to summarize the big point from the last thing. What Elster has laid out is a general strategy, what could be called a methodological strategy, for approaching the problem of explaining collective action, its variation across time and place, its successes and failures, when it's robust, when it's fragile, when it occurs, when it doesn't, what forms it takes. And he suggests that you begin by assuming that everybody is selfish and rational, and attempt to create a model that accounts for the particular case you're studying. So sometimes you do see iterated prisoner's dilemmas with tit-for-tat in place, with various kinds of efforts for organizations to create selective incentives to get people to participate. All of that would be the first strategy. By strategy, I mean the methodological strategy, the first kind of model. But if that doesn't seem to really capture the dynamics of a particular movement, then you explore the conditional altruist set of mechanisms. And in particular, then, the dual problem, how do we explain this shift of people's preferences to cooperative preferences, and how do we explain the information conditions? And then, if that doesn't seem to fully account for the kind of collective action and variation that you're studying, you then ask the question, well, what kinds of irrationalities may be in play here? And irrationalities can either increase or decrease collective action. So a kind of irrationality that would decrease it would be if people have a really exaggerated view of the dangers, of the costs of participation, because they've been manipulated by various kinds of propaganda that suggests that it's going to be very dangerous to participate when it isn't. That would be an example of a form of irrationality that is in the cultural environment of a particular collective action, which raises the costs of participation to the point that people decide not to participate, even though they would prefer to, but their preferences get manipulated by virtue of irrational views of the environment. Okay. Let's just briefly look at this last set, the social conditions for solidarity. The reason for elaborating all these things is because it actually does help us understand the historical and empirical variations. And indeed, you can look at Marx's own work and interpret a lot of the central themes of Marx's analysis, and certainly of Marxist analysis of collective action, as involving explorations of conditional altruism, of solidarity understood in this as an assurance game. And I'd like to focus on three elements of this would be considered sort of the classical Marxian menu for things you look at when you're studying collective action. First, in Marx, the issue of the concentration and interdependence of workers. This was one of Marx's big themes. He argued that the course of development of capitalism leads to an increasing concentration of workers in large factories. That's one of the things that happens. And their growing interdependence within the labor process. So two things happen as capitalism develops. The division of labor increases, so workers are interdependent, and they're aggregated. They get into bigger concentrations of labor, and within those concentrations, they're in deep interdependence with each other. How do we interpret those two developments? And he felt that both of those things contributes to class formation and class struggle. How would we interpret in terms of conditional altruism? Well, I would say that I would think of it this way. Increasing interdependence of workers, their increasing experience of interaction on the shop floor within in the workplace. This has particularly important impact on the preference orderings of workers, increasing the extent to which they care about each other. Interdependence acts as a counterforce to competitive pressures of the labor market. The competitive pressures generate selfish preference orderings. Interdependence undermines selfish preference orderings. Marx certainly felt that competition did undermine solidarity. Elster quotes him in The German Ideology as saying, this is a quote from Marx, competition separated individuals from one another, not only the bourgeoisie, but still more the workers, in spite of the fact that it brings them together. The division of labor, on the other hand, creates what Marx called the collective worker, which was a kind of metaphor, a way of thinking about the way in which this, the organic interdependencies produces a realization of your commonality and your shared experience with others, which would be part of the shift of preferences from purely selfish preferences to more altruistic one. Increasing concentration is important, that is, bringing large numbers of workers together in a single place, not simply because it affects the preferences of workers, but also because it affects the information conditions for struggle. In contrast, you know, to small-holding peasants that are dispersed in the countryside and have little interaction with each other, or workers in small dispersed shops, concentrated workers in large factories facilitates communication among people. They talk to each other, and they get a better sense of who they are, and they develop a richer information environment. Conditional altruism, therefore, would be facilitated by both of these processes, increased interdependence and increased concentration. Second kind of empirical issue, community. This is something that, in a way, we discussed a little bit in the context of race, right? Because one of the issues in race as a social construction is the way in which it both draws on and reinforces various kinds of communal identities and divisions. Conditional altruist preferences don't just fall from heaven. They're created through people's lived experience. And the lived experience of people that builds this sense of cooperation being your first preference, I think a lot of it comes from the experience of reciprocities and helping and sharing in times of distress. And that happens not just in the workplace, it also happens in community. Such experiences of reciprocity, of mutual aid, of coming to help in times of distress are more likely to be pervasive in communities which are class homogeneous, where people are in the same situation, than in communities that have deep cleavages. This is also, of course, a place, a situation where cultural division or religious division within a community can interfere with the building of those reciprocities that make you feel a shared fate with others, and thus a shared identity with them. These issues also have to do with another matter which is not given enough attention, which has to do with the degrees of mobility. Geographical mobility disrupts community. High levels of geographical mobility means that the people who are living in a place at a given point in time don't have shared historical memories of past contexts of reciprocity, mutual help, shared fate. Suburbanization, fragmentation of communities, high residential turnover, all these things tend to atomize people's preferences and make defection more likely, weakens the preference for cooperation. The preference for cooperation that comes out of the sense of shared identity and mutual caring. So if you take the love and duty couplet, I think it's the love part that gets eroded. The duty part wouldn't necessarily. So you could have strong political movements that instill a sense of duty that really convince people that this is the right thing to do, to cooperate. That could do a lot of work for you in terms of getting the preference orders right. But the other half of the equation, the altruism part, where you really do care about other people, that, I think, gets disrupted when there's a lot of geographical mobility. And that's one of the features of the United States. You know, there's various discussions of American exceptionalism. One thing that's not often emphasized is the extremely high level of geographical mobility in the U.S. compared to most other places. You know, most people in European countries live in the same place when they're adults. They live in the same place that they grew up in. You know, there is certainly geographical mobility, and it's increased over time, but it's orders of magnitude less than in the U.S. In the U.S., a very high percentage of the population do not live in the same towns where they were born. And that disrupts the preference orderings. You know, makes it less likely that you have the information conditions. You don't have the shared experience of past struggles where people did stay the course. And you don't have the shared identities and identifications, which makes you deeply concerned about their well-being. Finally, there's the issue of leadership, activists and organization. This, I think, is just an extremely intriguing and interesting issue, and one that has gotten a fair amount of discussion. It's certainly something that people know about. I mean, in the Marxian tradition, ever since Leninism, since Lenin came around, there was this understanding, yes, organization really matters, and leadership of organizations really matters. The whole notion of cadre, you know, the activist core of organizations, that's always been a centerpiece of Marxian understandings of what it takes to have collective action. What the game theory perspective suggests is that there are some problems that leadership solves that are not so obvious. And Elster emphasizes this idea that one of the things that leadership solves is the information problem. That is, in order to have information that gives you confidence that other people are going to make sacrifices, one way of doing it is to have confidence in the judgment of a leader. And the leader tells you other people are on board. So instead of you having to know if there's 500 people, so to speak, and you need to have confidence in that 300 of them are going to show up for the protest, instead of you having to know 300 people individually well enough to be confident about their behavior, and each of those 300 people having to know 300 people out of the 500 well, if you're part of a collectivity in which you're confident in the judgment of the leader, and the leader says, I've taken the pulse of the organization, and I've talked to many people, and I'm confident everybody will come out, well, the leader, using that as the symbol for the organization, that can give people confidence that the information conditions have been met in ways that would be much harder if they had to do it on their own. So that's one of the ways in which leadership and organization plays a role. Now, there's another idea around these issues, which actually was first developed by sociologists in the Wisconsin department. Jerry Marwell and Pam Oliver developed some work in the 1980s, which is called the theory of the critical mass, which is really the issue here. And that's the notion that the conditionality of conditional altruism is not a simple matter. In the formulation on the outline, it's me versus everyone else. I want to cooperate, that's my first choice, if everyone else cooperates. Well, that's a pretty harsh condition. I'm not going to cooperate unless everyone else cooperates. Well, almost no one places the threshold of their cooperation at that high a level. Most people who will participate in a collective action have some threshold, but it's far short of everyone else. Well, then here's the key idea. The thresholds of participation in a collective action, conditional on other people participating, it's important in a population as a whole that different people have different thresholds. And, you know, you can think of a simple kind of sequence. If you have 1,000 people that are potential cooperators, and 10 of them will participate so long as there are at least 5 other people who will participate, and they can find those 5 other people, then suddenly you'll get 10 participating. And if there's 50 people who will participate so long as 10 participates, Then it'll jump to 50. And then if there's another 200 people who will participate, so long as they are sure that at least 50 people participate, then it jumps up to 200. So you can see if you have the right distribution of thresholds, you can escalate pretty quickly. But suppose that there are 10 people that will only participate so long as 20. That's the lowest threshold. And there's only 10 people. The lowest threshold at which anybody participates is needing 20 participants. But there are only 10 people that have that threshold. You know, I'm giving a contrived case. Then you don't get participation. Now, here's the point that Elster makes, and I think he's right. At the very core of most successful operations, collective actions, there's a core cadre of activists who are actually unconditional cooperators. They want to cooperate regardless of what other people are going to do. I mean, not necessarily in the literal sense if they can't find a single other person, but they constitute a hard core of committed activists who through hell and high water are going to continue constituting this activist core. And that's the kind of seed of a tiered cascade that can become a big movement if the surrounding population has people who are willing to join a group, so long as there's a group of absolutely committed activists that they can count on. Then they're prepared to go to meetings and go to rallies because there's enough people in that core. And then again, this sort of tiered process gets going. So one, in this way of thinking about how the social context matters, collective actions can fail when there's a breakdown in some of these tiers. So you can day after day get rallies of 100 people, but it never escalates to 1,000. And that's because there's just not enough people who are prepared to participate in rallies that only have 100 people in them. Now, those thresholds can change. The sense they can change under conditions of emergency, under conditions of a sense of effervescence. You know, there's a kind of in the air. I mean, partially what happened in the Wisconsin rallies of 2.5 years ago is that things quickly escalated to the point that going to the demonstrations became a very attractive thing for lots of people, and it fueled it. And the occupation of the state capitol then kept the thing alive in it with a level of intensity that was really quite unprecedented. But it did follow a kind of mobilizing sequence that had some of these characteristics. Okay, that's enough, I think, about the logics of collective action and the way rationality and solidarity can be thought through under an assurance game model. And let's just open this up. We have a half hour for discussion of issues connected to this. Yeah?
I got a question about leadership. So Ostrom suggests that, you know, in the game theory, like, you have a democratically elected supervisor, and this supervisor could distribute this information, like, in time so that everybody would know that they could cooperate to gain the maximum gain. But my question is, I mean, if it's possible that this kind of supervisor would get elected every time, so it turns into a bureaucracy, like.
I don't think the premise of Elster's analysis has anything to do with election. Did he talk? I mean, I didn't reread it for this class, but it's more of the question of the nature of the networks that connect the leader to the membership, and whether the leadership has reliable information about members and members have confidence in leaders. That's more the issue than the question of whether the leader is how the leader is chosen in the first place. I mean, one mechanism certainly is election, but and you're right, of course, in any organization, elections can be superficial, they can be manipulated, they can essentially function as a in a bureaucratic way rather than a representative way. But I don't think that's not the point of his argument. The point of his argument is how leaders solve an information problem. And that can be true even in an organization that doesn't have a democratic structure. The advantage of a democratic structure is it's likely to increase the confidence that members have in the truth-telling of the leader. So for the leader to solve this information problem, people have to believe what the leader says. They have to believe that when the leader says, you know, there's a strong willingness to act, and I believe it's really there because et cetera, that the leader really conveys these ideas, people believe it. And a democratic accountability is one way of reinforcing that credibility.
Another question is, what if this game theory, like where people, everybody can vote, but they vote in an order, like, you know, it's always person A vote first, and B vote second. If the information is asymmetric, like the leader would know the results of the vote before he or she vote, then is that necessary to change the game?
I guess I don't understand the context in which the leader knows how each individual votes and the voting is done in a particular sequence and how that bears on the question of the willingness of people to cooperate or not.
What I mean is, if the leader knows that if there's enough people to cooperate, then he or she would cooperate. But, you know, the leader would have more information so that the benefit of the leader would be different from everybody else.
There's
a problem.
There's an infinite number of problems in these simple models that can be layered onto them depending upon the particular institutional rules that govern the connections between people, that govern the conditions of cooperation. And the role of leaders. So, of course, if leaders have purposes that are their own and they have more information than members, they can decide to withhold information. You know, let us suppose the leader doesn't want a collective action because from the leader's point of view, the leader is involved in a game of negotiation with powerful actors and the leader wants to keep the lid on the members. Right, so you have contexts where leaders are involved in negotiations with powerful people, and for their own personal advantage, as well as for the purposes of the group, the leader knows that everybody's prepared to go out and strike and storm the barricades and cause a lot of trouble. The people are willing to do it if they believed other people were going to do it, but the leader withholds that information for the leader's strategic purposes. Well, that can happen, of course. Leaders may not act as leaders of the members, but as leaders of an organization in which they're in control. These are all complications that can come in any concrete situation. And again, the methodological purpose of these models is to help give more precision to those complications. Yeah. Okay.
First one is collective action with irrational agents in the increasing aspect, is this the similar meaning with unconditional altruism? Is there the same thing?
No, because unconditional altruism is not irrational. It's just a different set of preferences. So This is a really important point, so it's a good thing you asked, because a lot of people assume incorrectly that when people talk about rational action, they also mean selfish action. And that's not true. That is, selfishness is a description of your preferences. You know, so in this simple little story here, Selfishness means you want B first and A second. That's all that selfishness means. That you'd rather have everybody else cooperate and you get the benefit without you participating. Rationality means that you are given your preferences, you don't make mistakes. You're making the correct choice of what to do, given your preferences. Now, altruism then is being used as a term to describe a particular ordering of your preferences. To be an altruistic person is to be someone who doesn't put your own interests and personal benefit first. An altruistic person who is someone who puts the well-being of others, including themselves. I mean, you're cooperating because you're part of that community, but you put that first. So your first preference is to cooperate and your second preference is to defect. If those are your preferences, in this context, those are referred to as altruistic preferences. But you can still be rational. There's nothing irrational about that. If you're altruistic, well, here's something that would be irrational if you're altruistic. If you really care about the well-being of others, and that's your primary concern, and if it is the case that you unilaterally cooperate, you just go out and are a martyr, and that would bring down the wrath of the state, which would harm everyone else. You know, if the consequence of your being a martyr would be to hurt everyone else, then it would be irrational to be a martyr. You know, that is, the irrationality would be not taking into account the consequences of your actions. So rationality refers to how good is the information on which you're acting, and are you making the best choice given the information and given your preferences? So altruism is perfectly rational. Selfishness is perfectly rational. Nasty maybe, but rational. Irrationality is when whatever your preferences are, you have false beliefs, incorrect views about the world. So that's an example of an incomplete explanation. It is never the case, never. So it's not just that it's usually. It is never the case that knowing that people are suffering is sufficient to explain collective action. People suffer throughout history, constantly, but collective action only happens sometime. It is not the case that people who are desperately poor are always rising up and fighting their oppressors. It doesn't happen all the time. It happens sometimes. So it's never a sufficient explanation. It may always be a necessary part of the explanation that people have grievances. But grievances are never enough to explain collective behavior. And that's because there's all sorts of reasons why grievances don't get translated into action. So in the case of peasants in history in China and elsewhere, one of the reasons that grievances don't get translated into action is that the repressive force is too strong. You know, that even though they are suffering, they know that if they try to protest, they're going to get killed. And it's, you know, there's things that are worse than suffering. They're not... So there's all sorts of reasons why, you know, and we've discussed, you know, some of them in these, in the lecture. So it's never the case that grievances are enough. You have to ask the question, given that it still is costly to struggle, even if you're desperately poor, it still costs something to struggle. Why are people prepared to pay those additional costs? And that's what invokes these issues around collective action. Now, one thing which we haven't talked about are things like anger and rage. So sometimes a reason why people engage in a fight is it's simply an expression of their anger and rage, and they're acting irrespective of what the consequences are. Now, that's why anger often adds irrationality to struggles. People struggle in ways which is self-destructive when they act out of anger. Now, anger can be part of a rational collective action. It can add energy to it. But if anger is the driving force, then people aren't calculating the cost and benefits. That's part of what's happening. Yeah, Maddie. And then.
So, like, most of what we've been talking about is solidarity between, like, the working class and the oppressed. But I was wondering, like, how important solidarity is to the capitalist class, and, like, how it connects to, like, competition, because, you know, like, they have to be competitive with each other. But then, like, you know, in cases of, like, merges and monopolies, they're cooperating.
Right.
So, like, how does solidarity fit into that?
It's a, you know, the question of the solidarity of ruling classes is an interesting problem. It's pretty unusual for capitalists to be willing to make real sacrifices for the well-being of other capitalists, right? So one thinks of solidarity among capitalists as much more narrowly self-interested. In which the main way they express their solidarity is by allocating part of their surplus. So they exploit workers and they make profits and they allocate part of the profits for political purposes to serve their interests. So they make the sacrifice, since they don't have to contribute to the Republican Party. The Koch brothers don't have to bankroll Walker. So they are making a sacrifice, you know. I mean, the Koch brothers are each worth $36 billion in net assets. Together, they are... The combined assets of the two brothers is more than Bill Gates. So Bill Gates is the richest person in the United States, I think $69 billion at the moment. But the combined assets of the two Koch brothers is just above Bill Gates's. At any rate, it's not much of a sacrifice. They give a billion here, a billion there. What's the big deal? You know, they. I think they contributed a few million dollars to the Walker campaign, but so the willingness to pay is the main expression of solidarity on the part of capitalists in the service of their political purposes. But it is a form of solidarity, and it isn't always. And sometimes there's division of interests, of course, so capitalists may be contributing to different collective actions. This may be just prejudice on my part. I don't see capitalists as constituting class solidarity in the way that we think of the conditional altruism of workers involving real solidarity in which they care about the well-being of others. I don't know. This is probably just my... I suppose that, you know, the Rockefellers might feel some sadness at the misfortune of the Vanderbilts, but you know, I don't. And I said this may be prejudice. I don't have a theory about the emotional life of ruling classes and their sense of identities and connectivity to others. To say anything other than glib and snotty comments about this. Yeah.
I was going to ask about when it comes to solidarity, is it always the case that there's a cost? And so I came up with like a little story in my head, right? Like you're participating in a sit-in. If 10 people are participating in a sit-in, police, there's a huge cost because police can easily break up a 10-person sit-in, right? And if there are 100 or 200 people, then it's more difficult and the cost goes down for participation. But at which point, so the Wisconsin Capitol occupation, for instance, or Occupy Wall Street, people were having a lot of fun,
right?
In those cases. And so like the... It almost seems like in some ways you can talk about the ways in which participating can actually be a benefit if you're, you know, making new friends and things like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. So that's why I invoked early on the sports metaphor, you know, that there isn't a collective action problem in playing a sport for the participants who like the sport. You know, there may be a practical coordination problem. How do you get people to show up because of busy schedules? But everybody wants to because the benefits come not from defecting. The benefits come. So those are in-process benefits. And one of the ways social movements build a culture of protest is by adding all sorts of things to the process of protests that are not costs. So music is really important. We know music is something that is powerful. It makes people feel good. It creates a lot of in-process benefits. One of the things that's been striking to me about the contrast between the protest movements of my youth, you know, when I was a student in the 60s and early 70s, and the waves of protests that have occurred in more recent years, is really how much more, what a bigger role music played in the earlier struggles. I mean, people would come to every protest. There'd be dozens of guitars. I mean, everybody was singing. That was just what you did, right? And that, for whatever reasons, it's not the central motif. Drums are way more important now. You know, so there were just not, drums did not appear at protests 40 years ago. I mean, I can't say never, but I don't remember ever a protest where there was the kind of drum beat sort of thing, which is a characteristic feature of protest today. Now, I personally think music is better than, I mean, I like both drums and music, but you know, if I had to pick, I think, so yes, in-process things do matter. The costs do vary by size, and that is an issue. So if you have people who are prepared to bear the costs of a small protest, but that triggers a big protest, that includes people who weren't prepared to pay the costs of a small protest, well, then you get that cascading thing going. Mostly in collective actions, the in-process benefits, I think, are a kind of side benefit that makes it less costly, more enjoyable, rather than actually means for most people there are no costs any longer. There may be no costs for a particular rally, but the long time participation over time in a movement ends up being costly to most people who are, you know, steadfast participants. And it makes those costs more bearable to also have fun alongside of it. You know, so that is an important element. I also think the fun aspects is also part of the altruism bit. I mean, it builds a sense of, you know, music, just as an example. It strengthens your sense of solidarity. Singing Solidarity Forever itself builds solidarity. You know, it reminds you of why you're there. It tells you in a deeper way than just a speech does why you're there. And reinforces that sense of duty. You're there because this is the right thing to do. And connectivity. You do this because your lives are bound up with the lives of others. Yeah.
It seems like going forward that instead of producing collective action that we're going to need more collective inaction, because it's more about concentration and interdependence of consumers versus workers. Would that change the analysis if we're trying to encourage to stop behavior versus encouraging behavior?
No, I mean, consumer boycotts and anti and environmental movements that want to shift people's consumption patterns, that all involves collective action still. That's action. You're really wanting to disrupt certain consumption patterns and create the facilities for alternatives. So, for example, an important aspect of consumption is transportation. It's a key issue, I think. And the creation of transportation alternatives is not simply telling people no longer drive cars. It's building public transportation and bike paths and doing all the other things you'd need to facilitate a life with a less carbon intensive form of transportation. And that requires collective action, both to change people's consumption behavior, but also to win the victories needed to build the facilities for alternatives. It's the same for food movements. There's a lot of activism around food and changing people's consumption patterns and locavore, I mean, all this sort of stuff around food. It's true that you're in one sense asking people to abstain from something that they currently do, but it's really more a question of trying to mobilize people around a different way of organizing their lives, I think. Dimitri.
The question of Joey and the notion that information matters in mobilization in this collective action. I think that people not only should know who will come, but their expectations matter. So they expect that someone will come, what do they feel about that? So I mean, people would individually definitely think our action will have no result. So they disbelieve in the result and they don't show. Or they may believe. At the same time, share their beliefs, show a result. So it's kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, and leaders' role matters in this thing to kind of transmit this kind of confidence and to kind of empower it, emphasize it. So it feels like it's a lot about emotions, expectations, trust in others, reacting to how confidently they say that I will show up. I will show up, so it depends on emotions.
Yeah, I think emotions are important here. I tend to emphasize the more cognitive aspects of these problems, not on the basis of research findings that shows that ideas and beliefs are more important than the emotional valence that is connected to them. I certainly do think that both are important. I'm anxious about the manipulability of emotions and the misuse of that capacity to raise emotions, and the way in which emotionality in the context of collective action can often lead to mistakes, serious mistakes, because of acting on the basis of passion uncorrected by a kind of cold understanding of the implications of different courses of action. I mean, examples would be things like in the occupation of the state capitol, there was a very big temptation early on to trash the building, right? You know, because that's one of the things that people do when they occupy centers of power, is they spray graffiti on the wall. Now, I think, fortunately, in this occupation, right from the start, people who were most actively involved in a kind of leadership way, that is, they were engaged in the logistics and coordination, felt, I think correctly, that graffiti spraying in the Capitol would have destroyed the whole thing instantly, and that they needed to treat the building with great respect and create patrols to stop graffiti, and when any occurred, to immediately clean it up, you know, to have a kind of no graffiti policy. And they met quickly with the janitorial services and others to figure out things, and they decided that one of the things they needed to do was to buy lots of reels of blue masking tape because it didn't mark the walls, whereas regular masking tape left residue and would therefore be more work for the janitorial staff. Now, that's a case where there's two things in play here. There's some strategic thinking that's, I say, cold rationality. I just mean it's just thinking clear-headedly, what are the consequences of doing this versus that for the things we care about? As best as we can figure that out, of course, people make mistakes, but, you know, thinking about the implications versus, I am so angry at the, you know, just smash it, right? When I lectured in Athens, Greece, in December of 2011, so this was 6 months after, 8 months after the occupation, and I showed a bunch of slides, and I showed all this blue masking tape, and I talked about one of the chants, which was one of the important chants inside the building, which was, whose house is this? It's our house. What is it called? It's the people's house. You know, this kind of call and response thing. Basically saying, we are appropriating our house. This is our government, not yours. The Greeks were just astounded at this because they said, you know, they thought, well, the first thing you do when you seize a building is you destroy it. You know, you want to, because the whole point, their view is, the whole point of a protest is to raise the costs to the enemy. And for them, expressing the anger by raising the costs was the whole point of what you would be doing. Whereas here, the point was trying to retrieve and, you know, sort of re-empower our own democratic capacities, and symbolically by respecting rather than destroying our common property. You know, so it was a very different kind of view, reflecting a much deeper alienation from the state in Greece than here, in part. I mean, people here still really do believe in democracy, even if they believe it's been hijacked, but they don't believe that it's not recoverable. Whereas in Greece, they feel that it's just corrupt from top to bottom, and there's just no possibility. Well, so that, I mean, that has to do with my hesitation about the emotional side of things. I think it often gets out of hand very rapidly. It leads people to do things in groups, particularly around issues of violence, that they would not otherwise do, and in retrospect, they wish they hadn't done. And it's manipulable. Of course, ideas and beliefs are also manipulable, but I know better how to combat false beliefs than overly excited emotion. Well, it's 12 o'clock. I think, you know, just one thing before. I'm going to start for the next, maybe for the rest of the semester, but certainly for the next lectures, at the beginning of the lecture to ask if there are any further thoughts from the previous one. Because these are ideas which are really important. I think they're super interesting, and it's likely, as you reflect, at least some of you will have further things you want to raise. So we'll spend the first few minutes at the beginning of the lecture just asking about the previous session. So think about anything you want to raise at the beginning of Tuesday.